Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. 2 hours of important programming the way we have it every week. Globalresearch.ca is the website edited by my co-host Michelle Chosedowski. It makes this program possible, and I'm delighted to be on with you today. The two topics in the first hour, occupied Palestine, Gaza under siege, an absolutely nightmarish situation. In the second hour, we'll talk about the economic crisis. But first things first, let me tell you about my guest who's been on before, Ramzi Baroud. Ramzi is a veteran Palestinian-American journalist, a former Al Jazeera producer. He's also taught in Australia. He's the editor-in-chief of the Palestine Chronicle website. It really is a vital resource. It's the best site I know for information about occupied Palestine, and Ramzi includes a lot more information on the site as well. I'm very grateful that he posts a good number of my articles. I'm very honored to be on the site. Ramzi has authored several books. He is writing articles all the time. He is a frequent commentator on what is going on in his former country. He was born in a Gaza refugee camp, so he knows the situation there. Gaza today is under siege. It's been under siege for over a year and a half, or about a year and a half. It's a desperate situation. Ramzi, welcome to the program. It's a big subject, and listeners need to hear more about it.
Thank you for having me again, Steve.
Oh, Ramzi, this is such a crucial subject. I fundamentally believe, and I've said it on air before, that unless this situation, the situation in occupied Palestine overall, unless it's resolved equitably, justly for the Palestinian people, there is no possibility for peace in the Middle East. And yet, America and Israel together do everything possible under the camouflage of a false peace process to assure that this never happens. It really is an outrageous situation. And of course, the dominant media says nothing about it.
Exactly, Steve. And, you know, the situation in Gaza, you know, the suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank really goes back much further than a year and a half or 2 years. Sadly, we kind of have to divide that suffering and that struggle through stages of what is bad and what is worse. It's not as if Gaza, you know, enjoyed a period of prosperity prior to the Israeli siege. You know, it's been under occupation since 1967, but even prior to that, it was living very dire economic and humanitarian situations during the period of the Egyptian control, and even prior to that, with the influx of refugees after the war of 1948. So Gaza is, you know, sadly accustomed to suffering, but it's really reaching a point right now where even by Gaza's poor standards, economic and social standards, it's reaching a point where even despite all of this, it's reaching a point where it's, you know, experiencing unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe. The siege on Gaza has never been so harsh and has never extended for so long and has never affected such a large number of people as it has these days. I mean, the numbers coming from Gaza are just absolutely...
Ramzi, let me interrupt. We absolutely have to go into that. We'll take a break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Ramzi Baroud. We're talking about occupied Palestine and Gaza. And Ramzi, just a quick comment. I absolutely agree that as egregious as conditions in Gaza have been for the last 18 months or so, and probably as bad now as they've ever been with everything just completely locked down, a gruesome medieval siege on 1.5 million civilian people, absolutely beyond belief. And not a whiff of it, not a whiff of news mentioned about this in the dominant media in this country. It's like the Palestinian people don't exist. But you have to go back. I don't know when the beginning was, but one thing that just jumps right up at me is to go back to the British betrayal in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration that during World War One, with the West winning out over the Ottoman Empire and carving up the Middle East the way they wanted it, and the Brits that have no right to be anywhere in that part of the world, deciding that the Jews will have a homeland in that part of the world. What gave them the right to say that? I mean, the indigenous people who had lived there for thousands of years, Ramsey, at least many hundreds of years, who gave the Brits the right to decide that a foreign element should come in and take the land away from the people to whom the land belonged? And then the 1948 war, Ramsey, Alain Papé was on my program some weeks back, but I wrote about his important book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, that he got official Israeli documents and showed the viciousness of what Israel calls its war of independence. I mean, it was a genocide against the Palestinian people, this mass slaughter that went on back at that time. And then, of course, Israel reinvents history and says, well, they left of their own accord. Yes, with the bullets and the bombs and the shells exploding all around them, they did what they could to find safety. Oh, Ramsey, well, you were born in a Gaza camp, so you saw this firsthand. But you pick it up with what's going on now or comments about what happened at earlier times.
Well, you know, this is really an interesting question. I know you did not mean it as you're looking for an exact answer to the question of who gave the British the right to do so, because naturally nobody has the right to control the lives of other people and you know, to determine their fate in so gruesome and so tragic a way. But the reality is, and has always been, that, you know, the colonial perception that the British had towards their subjects in the Middle East is that they are dispensable, they are disposable, they are not equal human beings with equal rights. So they've been used. They've been used throughout. In fact, I am working on a new book right now called Gaza, The Untold Story, with Pluto Press in London, and I'm reaching the chapter where I'm talking about the construction of the railroads that connect Gaza to Egypt. And I'm researching the history of that railroads. Why was it built and how was it built? And I'm discovering some amazing information about the number of peasants, poor Palestinian peasants, who were dragged from their safe homes throughout southern Palestine by the Turks and by the British, by the Ottomans and by the British, to construct railroads almost instantly in order for them to get their war supplies during World War One and fight each other at the Suez Canal. The result was thousands and thousands of innocent fellahin were killed and died in the process, whether trying to run away from that task or building it in the middle of the desert. Of course, very little of this is recorded in history. When we talk about World War II, we remember the British, we remember General Allenby, we remember the Ottomans, but we say very little about the peasants. In fact, lots of Palestinian books don't even make mention of that because, you know, they do their research based on Western references and so forth. So the reality is Gaza has been enduring and enduring for such a long time. The sad reality, though, is that we live in the 21st century. We live at a time where, human rights and such fundamentals are now taught at school levels, at elementary schools throughout the world. We are reaching a point where, as you described it, this medieval siege should be something of, you know, from history, you know, that we learn about in history books rather than something that we experience and see before our eyes and do very little about it. You know, again, Steve, the numbers are so grim. I mean, the Red Cross had a report that was published in the British Independent talking about 70%, and in my opinion, this is a moderate number, really, 70% of the population in Gaza are facing acute food insecurity.
Ramsey, I quoted it in my article.
exactly. 70% of the population are incapable of securing their daily food. 85% of the population is unemployed, and the chances are those who are employed, a large segment of them are doing daily labors and getting very little for their work. And yet, as you said, listen to the mainstream media, listen to CNN. It's not headline news in the New York Times. It's not breaking news anywhere. 250 people perished so far because they are just waiting on their deathbeds and they are not able to reach hospitals. But the reality is that the entire population has been struck and affected by this tragedy in which the world is not doing anything about.
It's hard to pick the country in the world that's the most egregious international law abuser. I think a lot of countries could line up and have very serious offenses mentioned against them. But I focus very heavily on my own country. Obviously, I live here. I would say that America tops the list, and very likely Israel would come in second place. But there are many others. I could have one program after another, Ramsey, just going around the world and talking about the abuses that go on in various countries, whether it be China or India or Pakistan or you name it. But, I'm obsessed with Israel because I'm Jewish. I'm not a self-hating Jew. I have the old-fashioned belief, Ramsey, that you do, that we believe in equity and justice. And it's not a religious issue, it's a justice issue. Jews have no more rights than Arab people do, or Muslim people do. We're all the same. We're of the same species. And for one people to abuse another people, whether it's taking away their land or simply abusing them, a bully on a block, beating up on a weaker person, that's inexcusable. It shouldn't be tolerated. And people who believe in equity and justice shouldn't stand for it. So I won't stand for it. I want to do more than just talk about it. So we discuss it on air. I write about it. This has to end. I believe someday it will end. And Ramsey, I really believe that the Israelis aren't as smart as they think they are. They've been doing this for over six decades, and it hasn't worked. You would think that they would catch on, that they can continue doing this, but they will not defeat these people because they won't allow themselves to be defeated. Sooner or later, this will end, and equity and justice will come. Why do we have to go through all of this until we get to that day? And I believe Noam Chomsky has said this, that he believes that Israel pursuing policies like this, in effect, is destroying itself. So it continues to do it. It seems to get worse, not better. And Israel is going through a process of self-destruction. What kind of smart leaders pursue policies like these?
You know, that's a question that I think maybe Ehud Olmert or Livni should be answering. However, I do think that these guys are smart, Steve. I don't think their behavior in Gaza and in the occupied territories and in the Golan and elsewhere is haphazard. I think it's all part of a strategy and a grand strategy. Israel, from the start, as Ilan Pappe has demonstrated in his excellent book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, is a colonial project. It's a project that is based on denying the other physically and actually psychologically as well. The other doesn't exist. I mean, we lived in Gaza. We had Israelis living in Tel Aviv that I would, run into perhaps by going with my father to Tel Aviv or through Israel to the West Bank at one point. And some of them would say, this is the first time we've ever seen an Arab or talked to an Arab. The reality is they live with them, but they try to live without them. They live with them and they see them as, just cheap laborers, people who are cleaning the streets, construction workers. They see them from afar, but they don't interact with them. Palestinians as far as many Israelis are concerned, only exist in the realm of subjects. They are the cheap laborers, and they are the people that they detain and they put in prison. So they really don't, they are so far away from the whole issue of equality and justice that you're talking about. It doesn't even click. It's not even on their radar whatsoever.
And now today, where Palestinians used to be employed as cheap labor, today this virtual exclusion. Of course, Gaza is completely locked down, completely isolated, and the West Bank is isolated in separate Palestinian communities, and Israel has its life, and it keeps itself separated from the Palestinians. It's really outrageous, but I guess the worst today, Ramsey, is going on in Gaza, and you've got the democratically elected Hamas government, the legitimate government of Palestine, elected by the people, by the Palestinian people, in an election. You remember the Israelis thought they had arranged it to see that the Fatah element won again, and the people were fed up with the corruption of Fatah, and they elected Hamas. And that was unacceptable to Israel and Washington. So there's been a war against Hamas since January 2006. And it continues on. Hamas has reached out, but its extension to live in peace with Israel has been spurned really violently. We need to take another break, and we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Back to the news hour. Ramsey, we have another break at the bottom of the hour. I saw a notice on an article on the Israeli paper Haaretz today, and I mentioned this in the article that I wrote. Libya sent a ship with humanitarian aid on it for the people of Gaza. The Israeli Navy met it, I guess, in the last 24 hours or so, turned the ship away, would not let it enter Gaza. It had the dangerous cargo on board of food, powdered milk, and blankets, according to Haaretz. Israel will not allow it in. So Gaza, with around a million and a half people, are effectively cut off from the outside world. Israel is allowing nothing in right now. They refused to allow in most everything for the past 18 months, but since the 5th of November, after the Israeli Defense Forces initiated an attack and Hamas responded in self-defense, then Hamas again is called a terrorist. The Israeli aggressor is called the victim. Reality is turned on its head, as it always is, Ramsey, and the Palestinian people suffer. Go into what's going on in occupied Gaza right now.
Well, I mean, the fact that reality is turned on its head, that's really the best depiction that I can think of. That's, in fact, exactly what is going on. When the elections in Palestine took place, a lot of people think of the elections as an exclusively Palestinian project. The reality is there was a Middle East democracy project that was going on at the time. As you know, President Bush was running out of pretexts of why he attacked Iraq in retrospect. And then he came up with this great charade called the Great Middle East Democracy Project, in which Gaza and the West Bank were supposed to be part of. But the plan was very simple. The plan was Fatah is going to win, Hamas is going to lose, Fatah are our friends and allies, Hamas is the enemy. Of course, Hamas is the enemy, not because of suicide bombings. That's reality turned on its head, because Hamas did not carry out any suicide bombings for years, and they have been adhering to a one-sided ceasefire. But reality turned on its head in the sense that Hamas is the enemy because Hamas wanted to cancel the unfair agreements of the past, and they wanted to adhere to international law in terms of or using international law as a frame of reference. As a way to deal with the problems with Israel, and basically they said that we are going to resist, and that is our right to do so if we are being attacked, and we reserve the right to exist, and we are not going to recognize Israel as long as Israel doesn't recognize us as an independent Palestinian state. So the charade was for Fatah to win, Hamas to lose. Unfortunately, from their point of view, that did not work out that way. Hamas won, and Hamas was leading the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. So Palestinians would have to pay a price, not just for the sake of collective punishment, It wasn't just because they wanted to make Palestinians suffer, as much as they were afraid, what kind of a message is this going to send to Palestinians and to rogue Arabs? What kind of a message is this going to send to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? What kind of a message is this going to send to the opposition elsewhere, in Saudi Arabia perhaps, and elsewhere? That democracy works to your favor, that you can actually make changes if you want to, that you can actually, by voting, you can turn the society upside down and change, bring some such historic change, such as the one that Hamas brought to Gaza and the West Bank. So the lesson, and this is why the U.S. was involved, the U.S. wasn't involved just because the U.S. would do anything that Israel wants it to do, which has been consistent throughout the years. But the U.S. was involved because it was afraid that its interest elsewhere in the Middle East were being hurt by that vote. So the Palestinian democratic experiment had to be contained, isolated, and eventually destroyed. And that is exactly what has been taking place for the last 2 years or so. The attempt to destroy Palestinian democracy, and unfortunately, I could confidently report that democracy has indeed been destroyed. There is no such thing as active Palestinian democratic institutions, parliamentary representations. A third of the Palestinian parliamentarians of Hamas are in Israeli jails. Some of them are actually in Palestinian Authority jails, being tortured, according to various organizations. The elected government has been deposed, and they are isolated and starved with the rest of the population in the Gaza Strip. The attack was against Palestinian democracy, but also against democracy at large in the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely, Ramsey, and the Israelis. This is a joint U.S.-Israeli project. The U.S. and Israel are partnered in everything that goes on in the region. And, of course, the U.S. supplies Israel with billions of dollars every year. Billions of U.S. Taxpayer dollars goes to support this militarization, this persecution of an innocent people. The U.S., of course, is interested in the region because it's resource-rich. Oil, of course, is the key. And the U.S. wants to be the world hegemon, and Israel wants to be the regional hegemon. And it really is a partnership of convenience, and it's a partnership created in hell. It's hell for the people of the region. It goes well beyond the Palestinians. I mean, Iraq is occupied now. And I saw a blurb, Ramsey, just now, as Obama today announces his national security team, that he wants to end the Iraq occupation in 16 months. Well, my response is rubbish. We intend to stay there forever. But that's a different topic for another day. And 16 months will go by. And it'll be another 16 months. We need to take another break, Ramsey.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Ramsey Baroud. We're talking about occupied Palestine, occupied Gaza, Gaza under siege. I just mentioned Iraq briefly, Ramsey. I've made a comment, and I think I've said it a couple of times in some of my writing. If people want to know the future of our plans, they're not going to work, but our plans for Iraq, think Korea, we arrived there in 1950, again meddling in an internal civil war in Korea, determined not to keep the more dominant North in those days from having an election and winning, because that's the way it would have turned out. The same thing in Vietnam. If the people were able to vote on their own, they would have voted for the wrong side, so that had to be prevented. In Palestine, the people did vote for the wrong side by electing Hamas, and it was a pretty convincing victory. So the people are paying a very, very severe price for electing the wrong government. And we call it democracy. We call it bringing democracy to the region, liberating the people. This kind of liberation people don't need. So Gazans are just suffering terribly, absolutely terribly, much like the Iraqis are suffering now. And by the way, international law is very clear on the right of self-defense, Ramsey, as I'm sure you know. People have the right to defend themselves, and if they are attacked, they have a right to shoot back. The law does not say you have to stand there and be shot down dead. The law says that you have a right to defend yourself when attacked, and this is what Hamas does. This is what Palestinians in the West Bank do, and they have a perfect right to do it. The U.S. and Israel calls this terrorism.
And, you know, James Beatrice, I'm sure you're familiar with some of his work, had an interesting article recently about, you know, how the peace movement in America and in Europe and elsewhere, but mostly centered in the Western world, kind of alienated their relationship towards resistance movements in the Third World. And it's really rather interesting and revealing of how, you know, self-defense and national and local resistance is something that we are too scared to identify with or to support in any way. You know, we are willing to sit and talk about the victimization of the innocents in Gaza, but we duly condemn terrorism. And by terrorism, we also mean the right of a Palestinian to stand his ground and to defend his refugee camp that is being attacked by Merkava tanks and being shelled by F-15s and Apache helicopters. We are too careful and too politically sensitive to say that, yes, international law has, in fact, supported the people's right to defend themselves. And various Geneva Conventions made mention of that, and various international laws in the UN made mention of that. So I really admire you, Steve, for bringing this up. People do indeed have the right to defend themselves. I very much admire the boats that go to Gaza in symbolic gestures of solidarity. But you understand that, you know, the help is not going to come from boats. It's not going to come on the back of a truck coming from Egypt. It's Gazans, and that's the lesson that they have learned throughout the years, Steve, is that at the end of the day, they are the one who ends up enduring. At the end of the day, they are the one who ends up paying the price, and at the end of the day, they are the one who ends up resisting. You see, so it is a good thing that you made mention of that. But another thing that I also want to mention, you brought the Korea example, and I think this has also taken place elsewhere in South America, especially in the Nicaragua case, where you had the Sandinistas being elected democratically to power, and that was something that the U.S. could not live with, you know, being seen as a leftist movement that is redistributing wealth. That is something that we certainly do not sanction, do not support. So there was this kind of attempt that took 12 years to fruition, and that is the strangulation of Nicaraguan democracy through all sorts of covert and overt operations that eventually turned the people away from the Sandinistas. Yes, you guys, we respect you, but I am sorry, we are not going to vote for you again. And they were voted out, I think, in 1990 or 91. But the point is, I worry that we are reaching a point in Gaza and in the West Bank that Palestinians are being given this example that this is how you are going to be treated if you make the same mistake again. Your fate is going to be that of Gaza. And this is how you are going to be rewarded if you make the right mistake, the right decision, and your fate is going to be like those of the West Bank. If new elections is being held today, I have no doubt that Hamas is going to lose. And it's not going to lose because Palestinians are cowards, but because there is a point and a limit for tolerance and endurance. And I'm afraid that Palestinians are reaching it, and I think this is exactly why Israel is pushing them and pushing them and pushing them at this point.
Oh, I am so dismayed to hear you say that. I am so, so dismayed. I hope somehow that maybe there'll be a new, maybe Hamas will use a different name, the same people, different name, and then Israel will have to figure out a way to demonize some new organization that sprung up, like a new political party that once in a while arises in different countries. they've arisen through the years in our history here in this country, Ramsey, where a new party came out of nowhere and an old one disappeared. And the Republican Party was born that way, 1853, if I have the date exactly right. And then 7 years later, they elected their first president, who happened to be Abraham Lincoln, a considerably different sort of president than the one we have right now. But I think it's also important to say, you may be right. The people just may want somehow, some way, to end the terrible conflict and terrible suffering that's going on now. And maybe we'll go back and elect Fatah again. But Fatah, at least under Mahmoud Abbas, has betrayed his own people. He's sold out. In my mind, you correct me if I'm wrong, but in my mind, he's been shameful in basically being complicit with the Israelis. He's welcomed in the White House with George Bush. Imagine a Hamas leader being welcomed in the White House or to sit down with the Israeli prime minister. I mean, it wouldn't happen.
And you know, Abbas is not welcomed because of his progressive moderate ideas. Abbas is welcomed because he is willing to play the game according to the rules of the U.S. and Israel. And Hamas is willing to play the rules according to the game according to the rules of the U.S. and Israel, they will also be welcomed to the White House. So they know exactly what is the price of the ticket of invitation to the White House, and some are willing to flip the bill and others are not.
In the case of Abbas,
unfortunately, he has paid that price time and again on the expense of his own people, and that is utterly shameful, in my opinion.
Let me say one thing to people who may not know this, but Hamas has made it very clear, number one, they're not a terrorist organization, even though the U.S. State Department lists them as a terrorist organization back in 1995, long before they were elected. Hamas has made it very clear they're willing to accept 22%, if I have the number right, the percentage right,
correct,
of the original Palestinian state, 78%, they're willing to give away to Israel. And just go back to 22%, roughly one-fifth of original Palestine. That's a very modest offer. I mean, you would think a very generous offer to make. We'll settle for one-fifth of our former country. That's the only thing we want. We want that percentage. And let us live in peace in our own country, on our own land. We don't want war with you. We don't want conflict with you. We don't want to kill you. We will recognize the state of Israel as the legitimate government of the land you claim. And all we want in return is you recognize us on 20% of our former country. Now, what could be a fairer offer than that? And Israel and the U.S. turns it down flat.
Because what the U.S. and Israel are seeking, or Israel in particular is seeking, is territorial domination in the West Bank and Gaza. And as far as the Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza, first of all, the demographics would have to work in favor of Israel. There has to be a minimal number of Arabs, so they do not disturb the demographics where Israeli Jews are the majority. That's number one. Number two, Israel wants to establish Bantu stands in the West Bank. They want to establish a very similar system to the one existed during the apartheid era in South Africa. They want to establish a population that is hapless and helpless and is confined within walls and within fences, and that is what the Israelis have actively been establishing and achieving in the West Bank and Gaza, and live according to the rules that Israel finds fit for them. Those who dare speak about freedom, justice, and equality are those who are going to continue to be hunted down and assassinated. And as long as that is the parameters of Israel's definitions of peace, this conflict is going to perpetuate on for a long, long time.
So Israel's definition of peace, Ramsey,
yes,
to just cut to the bottom line is, we will accept peace if you surrender. If you surrender all your rights and we run everything, and we decide everything, and we take all the land we want, and maybe we'll leave you with some scrub areas, completely isolated, Bantustans, as you say. The land, the scrub land with no resources that maybe Israel doesn't want and can live without for the time being. All the rest they want for themselves, all the more valued land if it has resources, if it has water. And again, total surrender, and then you're basically you're a non-people. We either use you to serve us in whatever way we wish, or we simply leave you isolated in your Bantu stands to get by in whatever way you can, which is pretty hard to do. What kind of terms are these? We gave the defeated Germans and Japanese at the end of World War II a much better deal than that.
Right.
And that was World War II, Ramsey.
Exactly. And it is the these are the terms of the powerful, of the military dominant. But what we are also learning, Steve, that is really interesting and revealing, that we have learned just recently, I would say in the last decade or so, that there are limits to military power. Obviously, you can blow up a lot of things if you have the right kind of bombs, but there are certain things that you really cannot affect and you cannot change, such as subduing a nation. I mean, look at what happened in Lebanon. Hezbollah, a group of few thousand lightly armed men. Look at the kind of resistance they have showed before the Israeli invasion in the summer of 2006. Look, the outcome of it. It has strategically changed the balances of power between Lebanon and between Israel. Israel is still baffled. How could that possibly happen? But also look at Gaza. I mean, let's also not underestimate the toughness of the people in Gaza. If Israel had a way to subdue Gazans to the last, they would have done it a long time ago. But they haven't, because they couldn't, because they really tried, but they couldn't. They have tried every brutal method you could think of, and every time they have failed. And the reason is Palestinians are strong when they resist collectively, and resistance here, when I talk about resistance, I'm not just referring to bullets. I am actually referring to a mindset that I will not surrender and I will not be defeated. And this is the mindset that allowed Palestinians to survive this long, Steve, so that you and I could actually sit and talk about it. Otherwise, this issue would have been resolved in Israel's favor a long time ago.
Ramsey, I feel this so strongly, and to me it is so inspiring, whether it's the people of Gaza, the Palestinians overall, the Hezbollah movement. Every time Israel does something awfully egregious, Hezbollah, I believe, grew out of Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And finally, this group of people that never before existed was born, and they ended up driving Israel out of southern Lebanon. I mean, Israel, the fourth most powerful military in the world, with every imaginable sophisticated weapon, nuclear bombs, the works. And you can almost say this ragtag bad group of freedom fighters drove this powerful army out of their country. The bottom a small sliver of southern Lebanon. It was really astonishing. And then Israel went to war again in the summer of 2006, if I got the summer right, 2006?
Yeah.
And Hezbollah drove them out again. I mean, it's more astonishing than a Hollywood script. I think if somebody wrote this as a Hollywood script, it would be turned down, because the producer would say, "Well, now that's impossible. How can a small group of rebels defeat the world's fourth most powerful military? Go back and rewrite this and give me a reasonable story." But it happened.
And Steve, it's also unbelievable because of the context in which this happens. Throughout the years, Israel's wars have been extremely easy, enough to allow Israel to go around the world talking about the invincibility of the Israeli army, the undefeatable Israeli army, the weak, coward Arabs, to the point that within the collective consciousness of Arabs, there has been this kind of feeling of defeatism and weakness. You know, the 1956 war, when Israel and France and Britain attacked the Suez Canal, Nasser ordered his forces out of the Suez Canal. They cleared out all the way to the western side of the Suez Canal. They did not even fire one bullet. The same thing happened in Iraq in this recent war. But then when the people rise, the story is entirely changed. The official army is defeated within days. In 1967, it was the Six-Day War. It's a joke. It wasn't a war. You see, it's like shooting ducks. But the reality is, when the people rise, that's when the official army can do very little about it, because these people are willing to fight to death. They are fighting for their freedom, for their dignity, for their self-respect, for their children, for their homes, for their neighborhoods. The story is entirely told in a different way. And that's what Israel finds so baffling and so surprising about the changes that are occurring in Gaza, in South Lebanon, and elsewhere in its conflict with the Arabs.
And America also, Ramsey, not just in Occupy Palestine, but in Iraq. Of course, the U.S. Is occupying Iraq with every intention of staying forever, as long as there's any oil around, and not just in Iraq, but the region. And the Iraqis want no part of it. The people want no part of it. A puppet government votes for this outrageous occupation pact to allow U.S. forces to stay. Well, there are no plans to leave. I mean, they may pull back to their super bases, but they plan to stay forever, again, as long as there's any oil around or enough oil around to make it worthwhile. And I mean, the Iraqis want their own country. And I like to say to people, imagine if another country, even an allied country, wanted to set up bases in the U.S. What if Germany wanted to set up bases around Chicago? What would the people of Chicago say about that? Well, I think there would be mass riots in the streets. Now, just imagine if a hostile country wanted to set up bases around Chicago. We wouldn't stand for it. But the U.S. does it all over the world. Oh, dear, we have another break, Ramsey. We'll come back and we'll finish up an hour that goes by much too fast. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindeman. I'm on with Ramsey Baroud. Ramsey, let me just mention a couple of things. I neglected at the top of the program to mention your most recent book, The Second Palestinian Intifada, A Chronicle of a People's Struggle. And I wrote about it. It's a glorious book. People, I guess, can get it very easily through Amazon. Is that right?
That's correct. It can be obtained through Amazon.com or through PlutoBooks.com as well.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. It's short. It's an easy read. And it will give listeners a real snapshot of what goes on. It covers the period of the Second Intifada that began in 2000. But it really covers what goes on in occupied Palestine all the time. And it's a wonderful account. Also, I want to mention your website again that listeners should know about and go to for crucial information on the region, occupied Palestine. And it's PalestineChronicle.com. And if people forget the .com, they can just Google Palestine Chronicle, and they'll find the site very easily. And again, it's full of information that you'll never get, obviously, in the dominant media. People who listen to this program know that. They listen because they get nothing in the dominant media. So they go to the alternative media like this program to find out what really is going on. Ramsey, we just have a few minutes left. Maybe you could sub. Oh, one other thing I did want to say. When your new book is out, would you let me know so I can get hold of it and write about it? I very much want to do that.
Most certainly. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have your input and have your recommendation to the readers. You've done a wonderful job reviewing so many important books out there, and again, it honored me when you reviewed my latest book, so thank you.
Well, Ramsey, I try to pick the best. I'm only one person. I tell people, I get asked to do this.
Well, you're doing a lot of work for one person.
Yeah, I tell people that, I want to do what I can, but I'm not Superman. So I try to do what I can, and I want to pick the best, and something you write absolutely is the best on a topic that I call one of my corest of core topics, absolutely, without question, which is why I keep coming back to it on this program so often. But we have just a few minutes left. Oh, my goodness, we have just maybe a couple of minutes. Maybe you can wrap it up in how you wish to do it.
Well, aside from the fact that I'd like to say thank you for having me on this program again, Steve, is the fact that I urge the readers to look at the situation in Gaza and in Palestine, thinking outside the box. Think outside the box. Think outside CNN and MSNBC and Fox. Listen to alternative radio programs like this one, like Democracy Now!, like other programs, and get the accurate information, but also try to go beyond that. Try to think of, as a global citizen, what can I do to help? What can I do to affect change, not just in Gaza, but anywhere in the world, whether it's Eastern Congo or Iraq or anywhere else? Because if we really don't pull together and we do not work as a community, as a global community, we will not change anything. The situation will continue to deteriorate and as bad as it is right now, and that is going to carry on without our interference. So as global citizens, we have got to play our part, and we can do that only by informing ourselves first, and second, by organizing, by thinking outside the box, and by doing something about it.
Ramsey, when enough people decide they want to do something, they can shake the world and they can make change happen, and it's the only way that it does happen. Oh, dear, we are out of time. Ramsey, again, it was a joy having you on. You will come back, right?
Oh, absolutely.
As things move along and we see more things happening, please do come back, and we'll resume this conversation to let people, to bring people up to date on what is happening. My great thanks to you today, Ramsey, for coming on. A great hour of discussion.
Thank you, Steve, for having me, and all the best with the show and future shows.
Oh, thank you so much, and please stay tuned for the second hour. We'll move on to the current economic crisis. Stay tuned.